Hello, and welcome to Notes of the North Talks, a series where we get to know our local Canadian musical talent. Today I'm here with Keiko Devo. Thank you so much, Keiko, for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
First things first, where are you joining us from today? Where in Canada do you call home?
Where in Canada do I call home? That's a different question. May perhaps I am joining you from Montreal, Quebec. I moved here in 2004 from the Kootenay Valley region in BC, so just outside of Nelson, BC. Of course, I grew up in Western Canada, but I've been here for so long that, in terms of being a composer in my community, this is definitely home.
Amazing. Is there any place else, maybe globally, that might have influenced your music?
I'm sure more than this, but I would consciously d say definitely Italy. Like, I spent a few summers in a row studying with Salvatore Sciarrino, and that him and the musicians we worked with there, and the other composers there, I would say just the general Italian scene had a huge impact on me.
Fantastic. Well, you started off in indie rock bands. So what first drew you to composition?
I always say the same story, and I'm just reflecting finally if this is true. I think it's true. I mean, I would say you kind of burn out a little bit, or at least I did, or you burn out for a period and you come back to it when you play in rock bands. Because if you have any level of success, you get a set of music or you're touring and promoting an album and you play the same songs over and over and over and over again. And it's a bit tiring, drink beer, eat burgers, and you grow out of that phase. It's very fun at first. And I would say I got to a point where my favorite part of being in rock bands was the recording part and being in the studio and workshopping and working on the sound of each piece. And so I think I just kind of gradually realized that I was more interested in the creative process, and being a performing musician in a rock band, it's only ends up being like a certain percentage of the experience. And so I realized I wanted to spend more time on that part of it.
We have a special guest today.
Okay, yeah, we do have a special guest presenting Yoshiko.
Is there a definitive moment or memory that you distinctly remember? You were like, oh my goodness, music is what I have to do.
I think when I was really young, I was a second child, and so my sister had the first cassette player, and then I had my parents' turntable, and it was at that age where, like, what was that music club where you spend a bunch of money and you get a bunch of CDs, like, but still, like, you're a kid and buying CDs isn't a really big thing. It was just coming out, and so I was listening to a lot of old vinyl, and so I think it created sort of an interior world for me where I was listening to a lot of music that my peers weren't listening to, and I wasn't really into the music that was popular by a lot of my peers. I mean, I was to a certain extent, I like popular music, but I was listening to, like, Cat Stevens and Taj Mahal and Beethoven and just other things of my parents' collection. And it sort of created an interior personal world for me, which now I realize really is very a shared world. But when I was young, it created this sort of interior space of reflection. I think that was really important. So I think reflecting upon that period, it just placed importance on, like, my own thoughts and reactions to music. And so maybe around then was when it started to kind of hold more weight and value to me.
That's awesome. Are there any musical habits or instincts from these early years and then the rock years that you still carry in your contemporary work?
Oh, tons. I mean, I would say, like, my desire or my need or whatever you want to say to hear, I say in quotations, to hear a work as I'm composing it is very important. I think that's true for a lot of people, but I have met composers who will admit that it's more about the concept and they leave elements to surprise and they don't really sit down and spend time like imagining a work or trying to find ways to simulate. And I'm not talking about, like, Sibelius playback, although sometimes that can be kind of hilarious. I'm talking, like, I'll create maquette versions of my pieces, or I will use found sounds to create really, really rough general symbolic ideas of the pieces that I'm going to instrumentalize. Or, like, I have to create, like, some kind of temporal experience for me to feel so that I can start moving the pieces around. And that definitely comes from one co-composing with other people, like me and the drummer, like looping things and be like, oh, do that one more measure, add three beats, you know, and just kind of moving as you go. And also, obviously, it comes from studio work and playing around in DAWs and like fixing things and making last minute decisions after you've recorded pieces to like embrace a glitch or something like that. So it definitely comes from that. I don't have this kind of conservatory outlook of like, oh, it must be perfect. And, you know, conceptually, we must not taint it. Like, I really like the process and what mistakes and errors and flaws. And yeah, and I have no shame that, like, I like to listen to my pieces to see how they feel to me. And that influences changes that I might make throughout. Yeah. I create a very regimented structure that I then allow myself to destroy later. That makes any sense. Like, it's just how I work. Like, I need pieces to be intuitive and I need to be able to make changes and they need to feel right. But I can't just kind of go into the void with this. Like, I need to have like a concept and a structure and an idea. And it can be really vague and I move things around. And then, I mean, I start with the concept and I think about what I want the experience to be or what I'm trying to question or interrogate or be curious about. And then I create sort of, and I think about what that experience is and how to create a structure and layers to explore that experience or interrogate that experience. And so I definitely always begin with the structure. I think about like what roles different instruments or sections are playing, where is like the noise tension, where is the tonal release or the tonal tension and the noise release. Like I think about, you know, I allow myself to write very intuitive like notes and post-its and put them on the wall. And I just really think about it in a very kind of rudimentary sort of childlike manner. That's, you know, how I start. And then I go into like motifs and harmony or sound and techniques and detail. But I have the idea and the overall experience of it, no matter how rough it is, has to be pretty clear to me.
I see. Are there any rituals you have to get the ideas flowing?
Lots probably. The one that I always think about. This is more of a ritual when I'm blocked for an idea. And I will sometimes, if I'm like overthinking something or feeling doubt about something, or just kind of like it's clouded and I'm tired and everything's whatever, I'm just feeling blocked, is I will write a bunch of ideas or listen to a bunch of sounds, read a bunch of things and kind of get myself all busy. And then I'll take a notepad and a pencil and I'll go to the bath and I'll fill the bath. And I'll just like submerge myself in water and I'll just like let my mind settle. And then I'll think about all my questions and kind of let them settle. And I find like they all the noise just kind of like settles. And the basic idea, like I just really want to hear that dyad. And then I want it to be floating. And then I want there to be like this kind of like glimmering, shimmering sound and then some white noise. That's all I want. Why am I overcomplicating this? Like it kind of puts me in this sort of very honest state. And so then I quickly take my pencil and like reach over the tub and kind of get back and center myself. So it's a bit of a ritual I use to kind of to get rid of the noise and to like really remember what I'm trying to do in the first place. Yeah.
Love that. It's almost like your mind reaches a state of tranquility and then it can refocus and then see what
Yeah.
you want to bring out.
Yeah.
If your process were a physical machine, what do you think it would look or sound like?
I don't know if I can think really, it would take too long for me to actually think of a machine that would represent that, but I can think of two machines that make me think of my works or parts of my process. And part of it, I would say, is maybe, and this is like a wink to like a piece I've done that's kind of about this. So this is a fictitious machine. So think of like an old radio where you could tune into sounds that have decayed and died. So this is actually a piece or an opera I wrote was about this idea of a machine or an old radio that Marconi, like this pioneer of the radio, when he was sort of at the end of his life and he was not quite there, was thinking, oh, one day we'll have a machine where we can tap into like the different sounds from the past, because sounds never die to him. And I thought, God, that's such an inspiring idea to think of that. And so I created a work where every movement of the opera, you're tuning into a different channel, into a different capsule. There's someone's. A lot of my ideas are based on the memory of sound, and this idea of like we can think of like what visually how time decays a physical object, but how would time decay sound? So it allowed me to distort sound and technology in my works to this idea of what does faded look like? What does deteriorated look like? You know, what are different ways to represent and make sounds sound more faded? So that was one. And the other one is the sort of like fictitious machine. So imagine an old phonograph, like a stylus that you can take and you can just like trace it along the floor or along the walls or around an object. So like you're playing records, but you're playing just like the textures of objects and sounds and things. So it's just like this, yeah. So these two kinds of machines that are kind of, that aren't real, but are based on machines that are real, but are just taking that one step further to sort of imagine or audialize the things that we can't hear. And to both due to time and the fact that sound does die, and also, you know, they perhaps fictitious ideas of sound, like the sounds that come from objects. Just like I like this idea of the inaudible and the imaginative, or the imagined, I should say. Yeah. So it's not actually demonstrative of how I process and, you know, left to right, but it is representative of how I. Of how I think about. We're just going to be very John Cageian about this interview, and I'm just going to like allow her groans to be there. It is representative of how I think about sound and what I think is beautiful and what I try to represent in sound.
Speaking along these lines of what is real, how do you reconcile the organic and the digital in your work? Do you see technology as a collaborator, translator, or more of an intruder?
I don't see it as an intruder myself and how I've used it. I see it definitely as a collaborator. I think I've used technology more in process than I have in the end result, right? Like creating maquettes. Like I wrote a piece called Excavated Sound about this idea of like digging and finding remnants of sound buried in the ground. And for that, I literally like took 4 to 6, I forget, it's been a while, like works, like some of the earliest works ever that existed either like in score or in stone format, and found, you know, contemporary recordings of them, and I just deformed them in ways and created this like electroacoustic work to kind of represent like this like excavating, discovering of these like dead and dying sounds, you know. And then I use that as an inspiration point to then instrumentalize just by ear and be inspired by to then compose. So in that way, I find technology very inspiring. It allows our ears and it allows us to take concepts and to push these sounds and the results in a way that we can't with our ears. And to create, you know, and just to play around and be more playful with these extremes and these ideas. It allows you to have like a conversation with like a what if, you know, and theorize about something. And then I also do think of it as a collaborator too, in an end result, like, you know, in playback or something like that. I haven't used hyper complex examples of technology in my works, but I would, you know, I just need, it needs to have a reason for me. Like, I do feel like there is, and this is maybe me being cynical, but I do feel like there is a tendency to be like, oh, I need to do something innovative. I'll just add some kind of tech to it. I'm being a little cynical, but there are people who do that, and I feel like there's a danger to kind of just add technology as a, sort of this representation of innovation when really it's not. The innovation is the idea to me. You know, and so I'm always really slow and careful, maybe too slow and too careful in interacting with technology as the end result, because I'm always questioning, like, do I need this? Like, do I need this? Like, I like to have humans involved. And of course, humans can manipulate live technology. It's not like they wouldn't be involved, but generally, sometimes the more weight you put on technology, the less you put on innovation in the actual writing for the performers. That's my own personal small fear of it. So I the majority of my works are instrumental for that reason.
How do you see the role of composers in today's world, especially alongside technology, then? Do you think we're ever going to reach a point where we aren't needed because the technology can do it?
I guess it's defined the term needed. If I'm really cynical, I'd say we already aren't needed if to some people's definition of the term needed, like, especially with AI for talking technology in the vast sense and not just as a tool in like in innovation. But, the more optimistic part of me is no, of course not. We're always going to be needed because I think when I listen to something that I know somebody, like a person, has composed or sung or performed and communicated, and then you feel that human effort in it, like it how it, resa it resounds differently with me than something I know that's been just processed. Like someone just sticks something into some kind of algorithm, and it shoots something out. Like I, for me, like being a composer is so much more beyond than the final the end result. Yeah, I think what does it mean to be needed as a composer, or what is the role, or what is the value of a composer? And it's way beyond the composition. It's that whole interaction. It's that community that we create, and it's that point of reflection about ideas that we create, and that won't that isn't well, that doesn't happen with a machine. It's about humans mentally, emotionally responding to like the political, the emotional world around them, and creating ideas and interacting with other artistic directors and colleagues and other composers and musicians about those ideas, and having those ideas inspire other people. And it's about that whole vibrant community. And you can create that sound again, and you can create patches that represent, aesthetics of certain composers for sure, but you can't create that community with technology.
I absolutely agree. On a slightly different note now, if you could describe the Canadian composition style in three words, what would you think?
I have to say, I'm very anti having a Canadian composer sound.
Ooh.
Is that a hot take? I just mean, and I've won like an award for being a Canadian composer, or the, but like my, but I think it's potentially problematic to have a sound. I mean, do I think that regions, geographical regions have sounds? Yeah, like schools, have sounds, and teachers, professors, and their students develop sounds because, this is how organisms work. We are, no matter how much we try to be different, we kind of like sort of assimilate a little bit and get inspired and sort of have similar aesthetics and sounds, et cetera. Little cultures, cultures around groups of people, around teachers, around schools. So of course there are ways that certain regions and universities and parts of Canada have tendencies to sound a certain way. But I kind of like, well, I'm going to take a stance and refuse to answer that question just because, or to answer it this way, just because I think it really should just be whatever it wants to be. And I hope that it goes more in the direction of being very incongruous and like and hyper diverse, and not diverse in that kind of like diversity kind of way, but just like very diverse, like where they don't agree with each other, they sound discordant. It's going to be like whiplash artistically to hear two pieces on the same program. That's how d different they're going to be. That's how I feel about it.
That's definitely a very valid and fascinating perspective. But you mentioned winning an award, and I know you won a Juno and a Priapus in the same year, which is very rare. But does external validation change your relationship to risk-taking in your art?
I mean, probably. I would say more generally, just when you have more experience composing, and sure, when you're validated as an even to something as simple as receiving a commission from a reputable organization and being supported to work on a piece, I'm more willing to take risks if I feel trusted, right? So it's not necessarily the prizes that make me feel validated, because don't get me wrong, like I feel like prizes, obviously I'm very grateful for these prizes, but prizes can also be political. They can also be a bit random and subjective depending on the juries, right? Like, when I've won prizes before, I've heard other pieces on the jury where it's just like apples and oranges. They're all amazing pieces, right? So for me, it's less the validation from prizes. I mean, of course I feel validated from those prizes, but it's more when like someone, an artistic director, approaches you and is like, hey, we really love your aesthetic, this is our vision for the festival, and we think your piece would fit well in this kind of hall, when you feel understood as a composer, I think then like that desire, not even like freedom, but that desire to take risks and, you know, create something even newer, and discover something newer comes in for sure.
In this case, do you ever feel a tension between creating what you want versus what other people intend for you to create, if that makes sense?
I would say that, yeah, like that tension comes in, and I think it's purely budgetary. In the set, maybe I've been commissioned before by someone who likes some of more of my conservative works, and I, for whatever reason, on some bent where I want to do something a little bit more daring. And but I think it's more in situations where I'm commissioned, and it's a certain kind of organization that I know only has two rehearsals in the 3 days leading up to the performance, and da 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 da. This is a really common tension, and it's something that I don't even think of as tension anymore, because you just kind of start to normalize it as a composer. Like, people, organizations either don't use their budgets or don't have the budgets to give more room for that exploration of new works. And so you sort of have to explore innovation in ways that can be explored by the musicians within certain restraints, right? So there's that tension. Like, you can't create like orchestral pieces that are hyperspatialized and people are like doing physical work and moving around and things are coming from the ceiling. I mean, I'm just describing something random here, but you know what I mean? Like, no matter how much an artistic director or an orchestra is game or your game to do something crazy, we all know how much it costs to do the rehearsals and all the admin work and the people behind the certain kinds of premieres. And so innovation, there's that tension of like, what do you really want to do as an artist if you just had all the power behind you, and what is feasible within like our culture and our, you know, the financial culture, basically.
If in a world everything was financially feasible, would you choose to create for yourself, or is there more of a consideration towards what the audience wants to hear? I guess there's also a tension I'm getting at between innovating as an artist, but also being accessible and more digestible for newer audiences.
Oh, I mean, I will say, if I were just to respond immediately, I would say more for myself. And I don't mean like for me, but I just mean I don't know what other people want. Like, I don't, right? And I'm not in the business of like commercializing my music. So all I can do is have questions with like my partner, with my best friend, with like musicians around me, people that inspire me, and talk about works that we'd like. And all I can do is feel what resonates with me and what I find is interesting. Where is there a hole? Like, what is of value, like creatively, to put out there? So in that respect, it's me. But when I say me, I mean me and the community around me, like everything that feeds into me, everything that inspires me. I don't think like, oh, I really think this would be interesting, but I don't think that audience is going to go for it. I kind of am optimistic in the sense of like, oh, I think this is really wild and interesting, and I'm curious how people were going to react to it. You know, like I don't go out of my way to like make audiences mad. I think my stuff, even the stuff I want to do, is fairly accessible. But if I think about my wildest kind of dream commission ideas and things that I've wanted to do that there's just not the support for, I still think they're accessible. Like, I think they're interesting. I think there'll be some people they won't resonate with, and or some people it's too contemporary or whatever. But that's not a concern to me.
If you had 10 seconds to convince a new listener to care about contemporary music, what would you play for them?
Oh, I mean, I would.
Okay, maybe a minute of your own music.
Really, well, the funny thing is like, I've been really re I'm remiss to like listen to new music these days. I actually just recently posted, being like, send me your album, send me things that are inspiring you, because I've just been busy with all the back end work and being a new mom. But like, I would probably, I'm not going to give a specific work because I feel like I'm going to regret it and think of something better later. But I'll say I would probably play like a choral work, or some kind of, or bring them to some kind of sound installation work. Because I think those works can have, I think the voice, especially like groups of voices, can have really beautiful impacts. And, if I'm speaking like to like a very public audience, someone who's not at all in the contemporary music world, it can, the voice has all these limitations on it, in terms of we can't just like, stick electronics and da 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 da. Well, we can actually, but there's more, it's rawer as a tool, as an instrument. And so I think it kind of resonates more with people who are not in that sort of music world. And yeah, I'm very inspired by like sound installation works, and mostly just because it makes you think of this thing is existing outside of you. Like you're not going there, and these people are going on stage to perform for you. You're just entering into space where the sound is happening, and I think it creates a different relationship with the listener and the sound that is a bit more for everyone. And not, like I think, like my mother, for example, would be respond better to a sound installation than potentially like a contemporary quartet of some works that have some kind of reference to some kind of author from a specific musical movement of da 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 da. You know what I mean? Like, so I find those works kind of inspiring.
That's so beautiful. As we're approaching the end of our talk now, do you have any words of wisdom to young musicians who may be listening?
I would probably, and this is probably pretty obvious, but I would say do exactly what you want to do. Like be yourself, to beat the cliche, and be really honest, not just with other people, but with yourself about what it is you want to say as an artist. Because it's not an easy world to work in. It's not forgiving, it's not financially very stable, and it can be emotionally difficult, and it's very challenging, but it's very beautiful. And so to kind of withstand all like the trials and tribulations that you have to go through in this world, you have to be doing something that really inspires you. And I think that seems obvious, but I think a lot of people kind of get sort of redirected by like people who are contacting them, and they kind of get brought into a world that isn't really quite what they want to do. And then everything just seems difficult and a lot harder. So I'd just say, like, take the time to really be honest with yourself and explore what you want to do, even if you don't think it's trendy or innovative or whatever. It's just, I think people need to be really honest about what they want to do, and then they will find success of some nature, even if it's just interior.
Incredible. Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode. So thank you so much, Keiko, for sharing such beautiful pieces of your art and heart. Until next time, folks, keep listening for the Notes of the North.